Hey, it's John Canzano. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Make sure you subscribe. And thanks to all the listeners and all of our sponsors who help make the Bald-Faced Truth the number one sports radio show in Portland. Enjoy.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to the Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth. John Canzano.
People don't like to hear the truth all the time. You know, people ask you questions, but they don't actually necessarily want to hear the answers.
Love him.
I mean, I like the guy. I listen to him every day.
Canzano, what's going on, man?
He's dead sexy.
I think he does a damn good job.
I'm going to be rooting for this young Portland team, which, you know, is a terrific team. You guys just have a terrific nucleus.
You pay attention to the detail. That's why you're so successful.
I just think he's honest. Straightforward and to the point.
You're bringing up something that's probably the average sports fan watching the game didn't pick up on.
I'm really glad to see that someone who speaks their mind is not afraid to tell it how it is.
He's a smart guy. That's my dude, man. Yeah, I know him, man.
I let my mother listen to him.
Hate him.
You don't want to get nobody a second chance. Trump.
To represent that as some sort of subterfuge by John Canzano, I would have expected far better.
He just sounds like an egotistical idiot.
He was rude, crude, and wrong.
Love to hate him.
Yo, John, I can't stand you. I can't stand you, but I come back every day to listen to the show.
Bald faith truth teller.
Who is he to judge?
Well, he can raise your eyebrows a lot.
I was angry. He just got my feathers that day big time.
Now, from the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth. Welcome to a special edition of the Best of the Bald-Faced Truth radio show.
Lenny Wilkins, legendary player coach, 92 Dream Team assistant coach, joining us. I have to ask him what that locker room was like. What was that locker room like in that Dream Team?
It was a great time, because people in Europe were starting to think that they had caught up with American basketball. And our guys wanted to show the world that we were still the best. And so it was great. It was a wonderful experience. And you know, anytime you get to represent your country on a world stage like that, it's awesome.
The locker room in general, because we hear a lot now about managing people, and you've had to manage locker rooms. Was that a difficult thing with all those egos, or did they kind of get it?
No, they got it. We let them know right from the beginning, you know, this is our goal. This is what we wanted, you know, and this is what we expect. You guys are professional. If you're the best, let's show the world you're the best. And they accepted the challenge.
13-time NBA All-Star as a player, 9 times as a player and 4 times as a coach. You were the coach of the year in the league. You won a championship in 79 as the coach of the Sonics. You had the Olympic gold medal in 96 with the U.S. men's basketball team. When I reel those things off, did you expect any of that, or did you see it unfolding? Was this all part of the Lenny Wilkins plan?
No. You know, I mean, you never know what life brings, but certainly, you know, as I went on in my career, I was excited, and you're always trying to be a little better than the last time that you stepped out there. So, no, it isn't anything that we expect or we think is just going to happen. You don't know that. But certainly, I think the goal is to try and accomplish and be as good as you can be.
Lenny Wilkins, our guest, you learned your basketball in Brooklyn on the playgrounds. We watch Steph Curry doing things with a basketball that are so creative and fun to watch. Does he remind you of that era of basketball where you saw guys with great skills and athleticism?
Oh, no question about it. There were a lot of guys. It's unfortunate. A lot of guys never even played in the league who had great skills. But, you know, we give Steph Curry all the credit because he worked hard to become as talented as he is. And certainly, you know, he reads situation. He loves playing the game. He loves competing. And that he got naturally from his dad and his mom. You know, they were both great athletes. And so I'm happy to see, you know, how well he's playing. And the guys around him accept it, and they play well, too.
They came to town. They came to Portland recently. And watching them, I thought, no, that is beautiful basketball with guys sharing the ball and passing. And it when you see that is, you know, as a coach, because we see a lot of bad basketball. What do you see around the NBA, and how different does what the Warriors do look to you?
Well, I think it's not difficult if you're willing to do it. And they're willing to pass the ball. If a guy's open, a teammate, they'll give him the ball. They play with great confidence, and they respect one another, you know. And, you know, we, our championship team in Seattle is the same way. We had guys that could pass the ball, that rebounded, that defended, that, you know, every time they stepped on the floor, they wanted to be as good as they could be. So I think it's great. I think it's great for the NBA. And there are a lot of good young teams, but in the NBA today, unfortunately, not all of them play both sides of the floor.
I've watched the Blazers, and their roster is far away from contending, but I see the backcourt with C.J. McCollum and Damian Lillard. It's very offensive-minded. They don't play defense, and they get torched on the defensive end. Can you work with guys like that? What is teaching defense as a coach come down to?
Well, it's work. You have to work at it every day. It just doesn't happen naturally. I mean, some guys have great quickness and everything, okay? The thing is, how do you use your quickness? And so it's something that you study video, you look at it. If you work on half court, you work on switching, you work on pressing, trapping, rotating. I mean, those are things that you work at. And when you work at it, you get a little bit better.
Lenny Wilkins is our guest. You won a championship as coach of the Sonics in 78-79, the only NBA title for that city, the Seattle's first championship since the Stanley Cup in 1917. What was that season like as it unfolded in that city?
Well, the city was excited. We were excited. You know, the year before, we got to the finals when no one thought we would, and I thought we had a chance to win then, but it didn't happen. But we were very confident that the next year, if we got back to the playoffs, that we could get through it and win it. So it was a lot of anticipation, a lot of excitement. The city was, you know, was thrilled. And the players were thrilled to be there. Was a goal that they had established for themselves, and we were very fortunate to win.
Dennis Johnson is the MVP of the finals. What was Dennis like as a player?
He was a terrific player. You know, he could play both ends of the floor, you know, defense, offense. You know, he was a competitor, and he wanted to be out there all the time. So, and you know, his teammates were the same way. You know, Dennis certainly deserved the MVP. And we had players like Gus Williams and Fred Brown and John Johnson, who was like a point forward before his time, Jack Sigma, Lonnie Shelton, Paul Silas, you know, I mean, these guys wanted to be there and wanted to compete.
You're an all-star MVP in 1971. When you walk into that locker room and look around, who else is in there? And are you kind of looking around going, I've arrived?
No. Listen, it was a thrill. I mean, to be in the all-star game, to compete against your fellow players. I mean, these guys, they were all all-stars. So the 1971 game was a great game. It was down in San Diego. And, it's just something I was happy that I was able to achieve that. And, I respect the guys I played with, and I think that they were all competitors.
How about 63, that first year? You come into that game, and it's Wilt Chamberlain and Jerry West in the Western locker room, and you look across the way, and it's Oscar Robertson and Bill Russell and Bob Cousy, and you look around. It's 63. Were you wide-eyed then or no?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, but, you know, I got drafted in 1960, and there was Oscar Robertson came in that same year as I did, Jerry West the same year, Daryl Inouye the same year.
Yeah.
And, you know, so we knew each other. We played against each other quite a bit. And so it was, you know, every time we stepped on the floor, we wanted to compete. And so, it was a great time.
I always ask the players now, you know, do they have a poster on their bedroom wall of a player? And who did you grow up saying, you know, that's the player I want to be, or imitating when you were on the playground playing?
Well, the player I was my role model was Jackie Robinson. You know, and I played baseball first, and then played and got into basketball. But certainly, he was a guy that had great confidence, came to play all the time, played with his head along with his talent. I just thought he was magnificent, and that was the guy that I said if I could be like anyone, I wanted to be like him.
Lenny Wilkins, our guest, Hall of Famer. The basketball today, you know, the Blazers are struggling a little bit, and, you know, this season has become about, you know, how good can this team be? You know, can they win some games, and can they be interesting? You know, they're sitting at 17 wins. As a fan, that's tough. When you're in the middle of a season like that as a player or a coach, how difficult is it to stay engaged?
Well, I never found it hard to stay engaged because I wanted to get better all the time. And I think if you talk to those young players, they want to get better. They think every time they come out, there's an opportunity to improve. And so, you know, they're not going to quit. They're not going to give up. It's tough, but every game's a new game. And that's how you have to look at it. Every time you step on that floor, there's a chance to win. So I think that's what they have to aim for every time.
Everybody's looking at the Warriors. Do you worry at all that they run themselves ragged trying to go 72-10?
Well, it's a lofty goal. I don't know if they could do that, but there's a lot of teams that are going to challenge them, you know, and they're going to feel good when they do beat them because they have such a great team and a great record. But you saw last night, they were challenged last night. And, and Charlotte beat them. But it's okay to go after them, you know, to play hard against them. And for them, they have to know that every time they go someplace, someone's going to feel good about trying to beat them.
You're 78 years old now. Do you still play horse? Do you shoot the basketball around?
I don't shoot it. I watch, you know. I like the game. I mean, I love the game, and yeah. I still I like good basketball. When I see a close game like the one last night, I mean, I get engaged, and so, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But now I don't play anymore.
Do you when you're watching a great game? I mean, do you prefer if I say, Lenny, hey, coach, I want to see a great game? Are you telling me to watch a college game? Or are you telling me to watch an NBA game? And what makes a great game?
Well, a great game is when teams compete, when they pass, when they defend. They don't just give up, or they don't let guys just walk to the basket. They help one another. They rotate. And you see that in college and pro. I mean, you know, listen, just because you're a pro doesn't mean that you take a night off. You don't. You got to come and play hard, and I want to see that whatever basketball game I watch, I want to see people competing. I want to see people trying, giving a great effort. Okay, that's what keeps me engaged.
The rhythm of a season is interesting to me, and you won that championship in 78-79. You've had other teams that, you know, three times you won 57 games in the regular season. Later, is there an art or a science to getting a team to peak at the right time?
Well, you know, I think the thing that, you know, one, you got to stay healthy. If you stay healthy, you got a good chance. Okay. Especially if players listen, if they pay attention, you know, and want to be better. So when you have that, okay, I think that's what makes the difference, is that coming every night to compete.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing. Is it hard? Did you find that frustrating? Because as a player, I imagine Lenny Wilkins showed up to play every night. And in, you know, 2,500 games coaching in the NBA, there had to be some nights where you looked at a guy and thought, does he realize how lucky he is to be in the league?
Well, we see that a lot, you know. We see that a lot. And we certainly, you know, you try to encourage young guys that, hey, this is your profession. You know, this is what you strive for. This is what you want. So, you know, give it your best effort every chance you get. And you know, and if you're giving your best effort, that's all I can ask for. But I don't want you to feel like you can take a night off.
Away from basketball, do you have a hobby?
I like music. I used to like to play a lot of tennis. I don't play as much now, and play a little golf every now and then. But I would say that music is more my hobby. Seeing good movies.
What if I give you a radio show and I say, Lenny, you can play all the music you want. You just got to tell stories between the songs. And what kind of music are you playing?
Well, I'm probably playing a lot of jazz, and I like, I like great singers. You know, when I was coming up as a kid, there was Sarah Vaughan, Ella Fitzgerald, Nancy Wilson, and people like that. And I enjoyed that. So, I also like, Dave Rubeck. There were a lot of talented artists, and I enjoy it.
I think we had Spencer Haywood on not too long ago. He was talking about music and mm-hmm. how into jazz music he is, and he had hosted a radio show at one time. And I like to hear, because we think about guys as just being around basketball all the time. I like hearing that you like to go see a movie and you're away from it. We see a lot of coaches who burn out that all they do is basketball or football. And I just don't know how you would battle exhaustion at some point.
Well, I think you got to have something else that you like. I mean, you really do. I enjoy music. I enjoy my grandkids. I enjoy being with them. I think that you got to find something else you enjoy.
Do you have a basketball player in the grandchildren?
I have a grandson who's 6. He's a heck of a little soccer player, and he likes basketball too. So it's early, but he enjoys it. And if he sees me, if he comes over and I'm watching a game, he'll come sit down with me and watch the game. And I don't have to force that on him. So I like that.
You like that he's got that love in him. Does he have any idea that Granddad is like 3 times over in the Hall of Fame?
Well, I don't think he knows all that. Not that at this point. It's a little early, but I just want him to enjoy sports and have fun with it and compete. And as long as he does that, that'll satisfy me.
Any shot that you'd coach one of his youth teams, even if it was rec league, 7-year-old kids running around?
Any what?
Any chance that you'd coach one of his teams?
Well, he lives in Atlanta.
Yeah, too far.
He's in Georgia. It's a little ways away, but my son, when I go there, I'll shoot baskets with him,
yeah.
And then I'll go watch his soccer games. So I have fun doing that.
All right, Coach, I really appreciate you making time for us, and we love having you on the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Want more of the Best of the Bald-Faced Truth radio show? Leave it right here. Here's John Canzano with the Bald-Faced Truth. You're listening to the Best of the Bald-Faced Truth radio show.
One of my favorite interviews that we did over the years came in the run-up to the Super Bowl in January of 2016. Super Bowl was ahead, and of course, a lot of talk about Cam Newton, a lot of talk about the Denver Broncos and Peyton Manning and HGH and... we got a chance to visit with Randy Cross, a 3-time Super Bowl champion, who talked about all those things, plus what it was like to play for a 49ers organization that had Bill Walsh leading it. Here's that interview with Randy Cross. 3-time Super Bowl champion Randy Cross joining us. I love having Randy Cross on the show. I know that players don't like to hear all this all the time put quite this way, Randy, but I grew up watching you play. And
thanks.
And
that's better than you were my mom's favorite player.
What do you, first of all, because we'll talk about Cam and Peyton and all that stuff down the road, but let's go back to your experiences in those different Super Bowls. Did it change for you each time? Did you get better at preparing?
A little bit. I think after once you've played in one, once you're prepared or you've been prepared properly for the experience from a time standpoint, that makes a huge difference. I mean, when we played in the first one, Bill kind of had us ready for the fact that we were going to sit around in the locker room a lot, and we were going to sit around on the field a lot before we actually got to play. So we came in from the jump kind of knowing it was going to be like that. And then in the subsequent Super Bowls, you had a much better idea on how to sort of regulate your emotions, because you'll see faces on the sideline during, say, the national anthem. The kickoff won't be another for 5 or 7 minutes after that. So there's guys that will peak, get going crazy, and actually, you know, be down again by the time the toe hits the ball. So it can be really a challenge to do it properly.
The Bill Walsh, that Super Bowl 16 against the Bengals, I mean, that team had come out of 2-14 and 6-10 seasons, and now you're in the Super Bowl and you guys have the goal line stand. And that team, was that different than maybe just a few years later when you got in there a couple more times?
No comparison, really. I mean, the 81 teams, I always referred to them as kind of the happy dummy. we had no idea. You know, we knew we were pretty good, but we didn't really know what we were doing. We had some older guys like Jack Reynolds and Charlie Young and a few guys that could give us some point of reference that it wasn't always this easy. We about partied ourselves to death after that Super Bowl. It's the reason we didn't make the playoffs the next year during that strike season. But it's also one of the reasons, you know, 83, we made it back to the NFC Championship game. And between that game, that loss, and sort of the experience we'd had from that year or so before that was sort of the impetus to that next team that was completely different kind of experience from 81 when we beat Marino and the Dolphins in 84.
Yeah, I was, you know, that comparison, because you're at Stanford Stadium for Super Bowl 19, you're back again. You now probably have an appreciation for how hard it is to get there if you didn't have it in 81. And you've got Montana against Marino, and nobody has any idea what Marino's going to be because he's a rookie. That buildup at your home stadium, because, you know, what advantage was that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's so funny because people still say, you know, a team's never played in a home Super Bowl. And I kind of laugh at him and go, oh, really?
Yeah.
Because Candlestick was probably a half hour from our training facility, and Stanford was like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
It was wild. We actually got Bill to put us in a hotel a day early. We were supposed to go into the hotel on Saturday, and we kind of went to him and said, can we go in the hotel a day early? Can we go in on Friday and get away from the families and the tickets and all the other garbage? I mean, when that does happen for a team, when they do have a home Super Bowl in their home stadium, man, I really feel for those people, because that whole experience it's not fun. Let's put it that way. It can be really distracting. We were just lucky that team was that good, because we were as good as advertised that year.
We're talking to Randy Cross, three-time Super Bowl champion. You won the NFC title game that year, 23-0 over the Bears. And I kind of thought about that when I saw the way Carolina was playing, because I thought that team, you know, you guys offensively and defensively had it together at the right time.
Yeah, we really did. You know, I was, after watching that Denver-New England game, you know, Sunday, I was excited, just sitting there going, boy, this is going to be a heck of a matchup in the Super Bowl. Then after watching Carolina just dismantle Arizona, who I thought was the team in the league that had the best chance of beating Carolina, I started to think, you know, this may be a revisit to that period of time when the NFC teams just used the AFC in the Super Bowl, where it was just blowouts and mismatches. And I think it still has that possibility, because I know one thing. Peyton Manning ain't going to beat this defense throwing the ball. There is no chance that's going to happen.
The defense at Carolina, because let's focus on both defenses, because everybody wants to talk about the quarterbacks. What do you see on defense for Carolina?
Well, I love their defense. They're very difficult to run against. They're excellent inside. They've got the size and the strength in there. They've got some good youth on the outside. You know, everyone looked at Jared Allen for a while when they picked him up. Now that he's kind of hurt, you know, Ely's played extremely well. They're coming off. They do an unbelievable job of blitzing and moving. You know, when it comes to going against a quarterback, whether it's Kuechly or Davis, how often did you see in that game where both those guys are standing in the A-gap And usually they weren't blitzing, but you sure as heck better allow for them. I just think their ability to man up, put Norman on somebody, and take that side of the field away gives them a real variety of things that Ron Rivera loves to do, blitzing and bringing different people.
Denver on the other side, defensive line did the same thing with New England. They made Tom Brady look very rattled and ordinary. What do you see on that Denver defense?
Well, they could possibly do the same thing. The interesting matchup to me is that offensive line against that front seven slash defensive line of Denver's, because, you know, Carolina's got sort of a no baloney group. They're big, they're physical, and they don't mind going after people. They protect pretty well. They've got some power running backs. They've got the largest sort of fullback slash running back in captivity, and it's at least per pound when you look at a guy like what Tolbert can do. He's like 5'8 and about 240. He's a whole different kind of change of pace guy that they bring. And then there's their 12th guy that you can't really allow for if you're a run defense, because Cam Newton, everyone says, well, you know, you can't run a quarterback in this league. Cam Newton's flipping like 6'5", 250.
Yeah.
There's a quarterback that can run in this league. That'd be one of them.
It reminds me of when we see LeBron in an NBA game, because physically he's bigger, and you don't expect him to do the things that he does. It's like a defensive end playing quarterback.
Yeah, it is. It is. And if you look back at it, and you know, if you got a DVR, you can go back and check. We always talk about the quarterbacks, and the good ones do it like matter of fact as far as the way that they set up, the way their footwork is such a key part of what they do. For Cam, he'll get pressure, and he won't be ready to throw, but somebody will be open. He can throw it anyway and put it on a rope and have really good touch on it. The difference in Cam from year one to now, and we forget he threw for over 4,000 yards as a rookie, his touch passes and his accuracy, I think, have come light years from where they were a couple of years ago. He's going to give you fits, because when you start looking at, you know, you want to compare receiver groups, I mean, who are the Carolina receivers besides Greg Olsen? But for some reason, he puts those balls out there, and no matter who they are, they go get them.
We're talking to Randy Cross, former All-American at UCLA, won a Rose Bowl in 76, obviously three-time Super Bowl champion. You played center, you played guard. Which of these offensive lines do you like better?
I like Carolina. I just think for what they do, they just match up, I think, a heck of a lot better. I mean, Denver, it's hard not to like, but they're a little bit like New England. They've used a pretty good variety of people on their offensive line. I think also they're protecting a quarterback that knows, you know, I have to throw everything on unbelievable time. I've got to have a running game. I think in this game, Denver's offensive line is definitely under the most pressure to get a running game going, because if they can't run the ball, they are really behind it.
We look at the NFL, and we, you know, the report comes out, and the NFL confirms that they're investigating the HGH stuff with Peyton Manning. They've been looking into it for weeks, and I guess there's no good time to do that. I just don't have a lot of faith that they can conduct a real investigation. Am I crazy for that?
No. I think you're going with the empirical evidence. I mean, hell, if they don't know how to inflate a ball, how are they going to investigate that?
Why is Cam Newton's age not an issue in this game? Like, I think if we had a 26-year-old quarterback that it was anybody else, we'd be saying, is this stage too big for him? Can he do this? I mean, I don't know if those things were said about Marino prior to that 84 Super Bowl, but what is it about Cam that makes nobody worry?
Well, yeah, and that's a good analogy, because I know I've heard some pretty credible people talk about this may be the best season in NFL history for a quarterback. And first guy I thought of was Marino in his second year doing what he did for Miami. But I think what Cam has done is he's had a maturity level that I think has been forced on him to a degree. He had that incident that happened in Florida, which made him, you know, go away from home, go to Blinn Community College, you know, do that experience, go to Auburn, the pressure and the maturity he needed to handle not only getting there, but what they went through that year. Then as a top pick, he's been in a situation where he's had to mature and grow up pretty quickly. And in that atmosphere, we've seen guys that have been able to take it and run with it and mature and grow. We've obviously seen more than enough of the Ryan Leaf that absolutely folded.
In your Super Bowl, you had a pretty good one with Joe Montana, especially early on there. What was it about Montana that – did you worry at all that he'd be rattled, or did you know in that first Super Bowl he's going to be okay?
Joe? Yeah, no, you never really worried about Joe being rattled. He was always ready to go. He came in like that. I mean, that was his reputation in high school. That was his reputation at Notre Dame. And he proved from the jump in San Francisco, you get him at the end of a game, you give him a chance. He finished halves and finished games better than anybody, I've ever been around and anybody I've ever seen. And that to me is one of the real separators with him and most everybody else they want to compare him to.
That last Super Bowl that you were in, you beat the Bengals 20-16, the John Taylor pass, 34 mm-hmm. seconds. Everybody talks about that huddle and that drive and the cool he had. And what do you remember from that drive?
Well, just from a selfish standpoint, I had an ineligible receiver downfield. I got banged by a linebacker and kind of went downfield and then went right back behind the line of scrimmage. But the official saw me and threw a flag. So he kind of pulled my butt out of the fire. I appreciate between he and Roger Craig and Taylor and Jerry Rice.
That drive, it felt as a Niner fan watching it, you knew that he'd find a way. You just didn't know how. As a player, do you have that same confidence?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, we started that drive. We needed a field goal to tie it up. And we had to go, we were on the 8-yard line, so it wasn't like it was not automatic. But once we got across the 50, the whole idea of a field goal, by then it was already gone. I mean, we were thinking about scoring a touchdown. And then he started looking at the clock and going, okay, let's score a touchdown, but let's do it with as little time on the clock as possible.
Bill Walsh retires after the game. I can't remember. Did you know, did players have a sense that this might be it for him?
Not really. I had talked to him on the plane going to Miami that week and told him that I was retiring and that, I would be announcing that at the media day. And being the astute person I am, I'm sitting there talking to him, and he goes, we win this game, there's no telling what I might do. And I never even paid any attention to that being in my own little world. But, I guess it was he and Eddie went to the AT&T, and they were in Carmel, Monterey area when he made that announcement. But that wasn't too surprising. That had been an incredibly tough year on him, I think for a lot of reasons. And he was going away at the right time.
I worked at the Mercury News before coming here to write for the Oregonian, and I got to spend some time with him. And we talked about him, taking care of his family and the family stuff that had happened to him. And I found him incredibly gracious, and that he was. It was a time, too, when the Niners organization had kind of pushed him out. They weren't really listening to him anymore, but he was a part of it. And I thought it was a shame that they weren't leaning on him more.
Yeah, that's been a real signature of the Niners now, is they're smarter than everybody from the top down. And it's kind of a shame, because anybody or any organization I've ever seen that goes sort of about business or about life in general, that they're smarter than everybody else, it's usually just a sign of insecurity. And it's something that I think invariably comes back and bites you on the backside. And they've been having a regular backside buffet there in San Francisco for quite a few years.
Do you think Chip Kelly turns it around, or are you waiting to see?
I wish him the best of luck. I hope he can manage those different personalities and egos. And I'm not talking about the players and the coaches. I'm talking about the front office, the owner, everybody else that are, there. I think Harbaugh's big down fall was he got too much credit and attention, because they didn't get as much attention as they wanted, and they figured the best way to get a little attention for themselves was to get rid of the guy that was sucking it all up.
got rid of him, and all of a sudden they couldn't win. And I kept thinking about Eddie D. And
amazing how that works, isn't it?
Yeah, but I could never have imagined Eddie D. flushing a coach that had been successful. He would have just kept that rolling.
Well, yeah, I mean, you look at 3 years where, you know, you've been to the NFC Championship game, you've been to the Super Bowl, and suddenly you have like an 8-8 year, and you fire the guy? I mean, on what planet does that usually happen? I mean, but I must be honest, you know, that wouldn't have happened with our old organization, but that's not to say it's unprecedented. I mean, look where Chip Kelly's coming from. Philadelphia Eagles, when was the last time they won a world championship? 1960? And he came in, went 10-6 back-to-back years and had a losing year last year. And as soon as that happened, they all sort of descended on him. So I think Chip is a cutting-edge guy. I just hope he gets the help there to get the personnel that will enable him to do what he wants to or what he's going to need to do.
All right, before I cut you loose, we've got Harbaugh now at Michigan. He overbooked the flight when it comes to recruiting, and now their players are kind of left in a lurch with signing day coming. Is that just major college football today? And could you have ever imagined that happening when you were headed to UCLA, that you would have had the rug pulled out from you at the end?
Oh, I don't think that's anything that started recently. I mean, I know out here, you know, in the SEC area, over recruiting is a way of life. I mean, heck, they'll sign 30 guys when they have 20 scholarships available because they know that some guys won't get in, other guys won't be able to get out of high school properly, other people won't qualify. I believe it's a fairly common occurrence. But, you know, Big Ten used to be a whole different atmosphere to recruit in. I think people are making a lot more analogies now between the Big Ten and the SEC when it comes to people kind of getting dirty deals at times. But Harbaugh will adjust. He'll be okay.
Love that stuff with Randy Cross, especially the stuff about Cam Newton and running quarterbacks. Because over the years, what have we talked about? The ability to keep a quarterback healthy in the NFL. We see the number of teams that have to go to their number two or number three. It's become an epidemic in the NFL over the years, and the fact that Cam Newton and the Carolina Panthers have been able to keep that guy effective running the football and mostly healthy has been a big advantage for the Carolina Panthers. Our next interview coming up is with a legendary Dallas Cowboy and a guy who's got a hobby that might surprise you, a defensive lineman with a hobby that doesn't fit the stereotype for a defensive lineman, Bob Lilly, Pro Football Hall of Famer. Hear that interview that I did with Bob Lilly next.
You're listening to the best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show. Stay tuned for more.
Something is about to happen.
BFT.
Now listen up, everyone.
Let's go. The Bald-Faced Truth.
John Canzano.
I gotta say, I love him most of the time. I think he's right on.
He's okay.
John's great.
He's a little unusual.
Live every afternoon, 12 to 3 p.m.
I hate that guy because he just never knows what he's talking about.
I think he does a damn good job.
That's my dude, man. Yeah, I know him, man. I let my mother listen to him.
Now, from the Pac West Center in downtown Portland, here's John Canzano with a Bald-Faced Truth. Welcome to a special edition of the Best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show.
The Cowboys face the extreme polar conditions with a mixture of fear and loathing. No one was prepared for this kind of weather. Even some of the Packers had trouble starting their cars and getting to the game.
Talk about the Ice Bowl. Bob Lilly with us, former Cowboy great, Hall of Famer, joining us. Give us an idea of what it's like to try to do your job under those conditions.
Well, I'll give you an idea of the conditions. At about 7 o'clock, my roommate, George Andrey, had been down to have a cup of coffee, and he came back, took a glass of water. We were staying at the Holiday Inn right outside of Green Bay, and he tossed it against the window, and most of it froze before it hit the bottom. He said, well, it's already 12 degrees below zero. It's supposed to get to 30 below. And we expected the day before, the weather said that it would probably be 5 o'clock in the evening before the front hit. So anyway, by the time the game was over, it was about 27 below zero and a 35-mile-an-hour wind. And I think the chill factor was 55 below zero. And we were ill prepared, to say the least. We did have some long handle underwear, and we had some Saran wrap, and that was about it.
What do you do with a Saran wrap?
Put it around your feet because our feet were so cold, and we didn't have wool socks. We just had the white cotton socks.
Wow.
So we put that on our outside of the socks, and then put it in the shoe and tightened the shoe down real good, and it kept kept the heat in pretty well.
You also had an NFL record, a 29-yard sack in Super Bowl VI. What was it like to sack a guy for 30-yard loss?
Well, he was traversing the field a little bit, so I really didn't think about the how deep the loss was, but I did have help from Larry Cole. Larry played, I think, in Hawaii, but he was a defensive end on the other side. I played defensive tackle on the right side, and we had a stunt on both sides. Larry went first on his side. Jethro Pugh, the tackle, came around, and I went first on my side, and the defensive end, George Andrew, came around me. And anyway, I got through. I grabbed his tackle. The way we worked it, I grabbed his tackle so he couldn't get off on George. And my guard went with me, and then they both let me go as I was holding on to him so George could get through, and I was free. And I was, I was after Greasy, and Larry Cole got through pretty quickly. So Greasy tried to run forward, but Larry was right in front of him, so he had to keep going backwards and sideways. And fortunately, I could outrun Larry, so I caught him first. But anyway, I didn't really know anything about it until it was over. And they said, "You had a 29.5-yard sack." And I said, "Well, that's a pretty long sack." I said, "I've never had one like that." And they said, no one else has either in Super Bowl." But it was kind of a shocker.
Our guest, Bob Lilly, Mr. Cowboy. You grew up in a town in Texas, Throckmorton, Texas, now has a population just over 800. You moved with your family to Pendleton, Oregon, when in the mid of the Dust Bowl. Is that right?
That's right. It was in the '50s, and we were farmers. We were custom farmers, basically. We did combining and hay baling and plowing, and then we had two caterpillars that we dozed mesquite trees off of ranch land, and we dug. We built the pads that they put the drilling rigs on for drilling for oil back in those days. We also built ponds for the farmers. And the farmers finally just ran out of money. And then the Arab oil started coming over at $1 a barrel. And that stopped the drilling and our work in the oil fields. So my mother had an uncle that lived in up near Pendleton. And his son got Dad a job up there. Actually, had the first job was in Hermiston, but the next job was in Pendleton. So we sold our home, we sold our machinery, and we had one little car left. And Dad built a trailer, and we looked like the Beverly Hillbillies coming to Oregon. But I was thinking all the way up there. I was thinking, we're going to the end of the world, and I don't know anybody except. Uncle and a cousin, and I just was very apprehensive because I'd lived in Throckmorton all my life, and it was a small town, and we had a lot of kinfolks there. But it turned out that was one of the best years of my life. Really, a farming, ranching community, whether it's in Pendleton, Oregon, or in West Texas, is pretty similar. People are pretty similar. They have the same. Things in common as far as taking care of the cattle and tilling the fields and, cutting the hay and all the different things and cutting the wheat. Of course, Pendleton was a big wheat market, and also it had timber, which we didn't. But the people were very similar. It was about, I think Pendleton at that time was maybe 15,000 people, which was a lot bigger, obviously, than Throckmorton.
Yeah, you must have looked around and thought, I'd moved to the big city.
I thought I'd move to the big city. We even had a movie theater, outdoor drive-in, and it was very nice. Coach Requa was a pretty notable coach in Oregon. He had won, I think he won 330 games or 333 games during his tenure there, and he retired actually from Pendleton. And I remain good friends with all those people, and I've been up to many homecomings, and I'm in the Pendleton the Pendleton, Don Requa, Pendleton Linebackers Hall of Fame. I'm one of the guys in it. So I've kept my ties there. I do have some relatives up in the Seattle area too, but it was just it was a wonderful year. I think if I had have spent 2 or 3 years up there, I might have stayed. But I was always had gone to football games at TCU with my dad because they let my dad in free because he was kind of crippled in one leg. And so, anyway, he took me with him starting in eighth grade. I went to many, many TCU football games, and that was a small school, and a lot of people from Throckmorton in that area went to college there. And I did visit Oregon, and I came very close to letting Coach Casanova talk me into coming to Oregon. He was a lovely man. He was a gentleman and a fine person, good coach, and they had an assistant coach named Fry, I believe, back then, and he was also showed me around. And I visited Oregon, I think, three or four times. We played in the state final basketball tournament in Eugene, and so I got to see more of it, actually. Got to meet some of their players, and, you know, I gave it a lot of consideration, but ended up coming back to Texas.
Bob Lilly is our guest. You know, I read a story about the Cowboys playing in the wake of the Kennedy assassination, November 22nd, 1963. What do you remember from that day? What do you remember from that time?
Well, the game actually was in Cleveland, but should have been postponed, yes. I don't think anybody wanted to play us or the other teams, especially Dallas. And I do believe that the people probably weren't just in a great mood to get out and go to a football game. Maybe it took their mind off of it. But that was a very tough time, especially for the Cowboys, because we still had a couple of road games to go, and it followed us for a couple more seasons, you know, after that. But we had to go play Cleveland, and they weren't real warm up there, to say the least, and I don't blame them. I mean, I can understand, although we certainly had nothing to do with it, but we felt we thought we might get shot before we got out of there, but we didn't. But anyway, I think football is what kind of brought Dallas out of the darkness as far as that's concerned. It was kind of blamed on Dallas, although Lee Harvey Oswald is the one that we all think did the shooting, and he was trained partially in Russia and had come via Cuba. And actually, you know, we should have probably been watching him. He should have been on the watch list way back. But anyway, he had been shooting out at the shooting range. I didn't know that at the time, all that came up. But anyway, then he was killed right there by the jail. And it was just a tragedy after tragedy. And it was, you know, the pictures of the Kennedy children, and it was so sad. And here we had a young man that was very bright and appeared to be a great leader for our country. And there he was, you know, shot right in the downtown city of Dallas, which really set Dallas and Texas back for many years.
Did the people in Cleveland blame Dallas? Did they look at it as that city took our president, and you guys come to town and you're representing Dallas?
I think so. I think everybody did. I think it happened for about 2 or 3 years, because they would boo us and they would say things like that. And, you know, we didn't know what to do, but I think, you know, we got Bob Hayes, we had Don Meredith, Coach Landry was an All-American guy. And once we started winning in the 65-66, our team became a pretty good team, and Meredith Hayes was a big play. And we had guys like Mel Renfro, too, from the University of Oregon. Mel was a superstar. And we had a lot of guys that were really good, and we started playing good football, got into playoffs. Could have gone to the first Super Bowl in 66 and 67, missed out to Green Bay in the both games in the last few minutes of the game. But You know, Roger came to the Cowboys in 68, I believe 69, and he had been played at Navy, Heisman Trophy winner, and fought in Vietnam and came back and joined the team after he finished his four-year stint. And he led us to Super Bowl VI victory, actually, and he was a big part of our team from then on. But we became, somewhere in there in 71, I think, maybe called America's team. So it took all those years from 63 to probably 1970 to get over the backlash, you know, that we had. And pretty soon it was all gone. I mean, we didn't ever hear another thing about it, although I've been asked about it many times. But it was very distracting for our guys to, you know, just every time you go home, you read about it, you see it on TV, and it took away, you know, from your concentration and preparation for football games. And I think by the third year, though, by 65, we were starting to at least get it out of our system, and most of the people in the country were as well. But it still always will be remembered. And, the building is still there, and we all thought Coach Landry was going to let us go down and see the, you know, see his parade. And I don't know whether I wish we had him or whether I'm glad we weren't, but we had to go to Cleveland, so I guess we needed to practice. But I think everybody agrees. I know the Cleveland Browns didn't feel like playing. They beat us pretty good. But I talked to some of the guys after the game that I knew, and they all said, I don't think we should have played today. And I don't either. I don't think I think it should have been called.
You became a Kodak All-American and then became a photographer. Is that where your photography interest started?
Yeah, that's where it started, John. I went to four or five different teams up there. Back in the day when I played college football, we played both ways. So you only had generally about 13 players. They had a kicker, and then they usually had a safety that took the place of the quarterback. The quarterbacks got to come out, and they sent another man in. So it was amazing, I mean, to have such few people and compared to in today's world, you know. But one of the Hall of Fames, All-American teams was the Coaches All-American team sponsored by Kodak. And we went to the Rathskeller, which is a restaurant in the Bowery back then, in underground. And it was a very small group, probably three or four reporters and three or four representatives from Kodak, and probably 12 or 13 players and maybe two or three other guys, and that was it. And they had these boxes all stacked up, and each one had a very nice Kodak camera made in Germany with Schneider lens on it. And it was very, very modern for that time. It had a wind-up motor instead of an electric motor, and it had a cube flashes you put on top. But the 35-millimeter film was the same as it's always been. And they gave each of us the camera and 100 rolls of black-and-white film and 100 rolls of color film. And they gave us 200 prepaid mailers that we just put our name and return address, sent it up to Kodak, and they returned our pictures printed and our negatives, which I still have, as a matter of fact. And anyway, I started right off taking pictures. I was played in, I think, three All-Star games, probably. One was in San Francisco. It was a Shriners All-Star game. The other was a Hula Bowl. And then I played in another one up in Buffalo, New York, and I can't remember. That was an East-West or something. I can't remember what it was. But I started taking that little camera around with me, which I still have, as a matter of fact, and taking pictures. In the first year of my career, I took pictures of my teammates, and then the next year I took pictures with it until about halfway through the season, and I decided I'd buy a better camera. Even though it was a good camera, I couldn't interchange the lenses. So I got a Leica, a little M Leica, which is a rangefinder and three lenses. And I also built me a darkroom for the first time. So my second year in pro football, I had a little converted bathroom, which I could unconvert real quickly. And I started printing prints, and I still do it to this day. Only in today's world, I do it digitally. But it's been a really fun hobby that I've started taking landscape pictures later on, and I bought a Hasselblad, which was a little bigger format, and then ultimately I bought a 4x5 camera, 4x5 inch, where you use sheet film. And I had real dark rooms for a number of years. I had my own dark rooms, and it was a great hobby. I still love it. I just don't have as many friends left to go out and photograph with as I used to, or I'd be out in the mountains right now.
Let me ask you, what is it about that appeals to you? And is it that you play a game of football and the game ends and it's over and you have nothing to show for it, but, you know, the score of the game, you don't really have a tangible object? Is capturing a photo so different than the career you did?
Well, I'm really, you know, I think it's more of a challenge, John. We knew, I mean, I had friends and we all had been lots of places, and we knew we traveled a lot. I mean, we'd go to California, we'd go to Oregon, we'd go to New Mexico. But we knew where the pictures were. We'd go to Arizona quite often, West Texas, but we liked things like ghost towns and old abandoned ranch houses and old wooden windmills that were still out in the fields. And we liked those. We liked the aspens turning in the autumn and, you know, the New England trees turning in the autumn. The old fences, I think I like things of that nature. But part of it was knowing where to be and what time of year to be there and what time of day to be there. Those are the things that we kept logs on so that we knew if we were going to take a trip to, say, New Mexico and shoot the old missions that are all throughout New Mexico, then we knew the time of year to be there, and we knew that we could work in an aspen shoot along with it, and we knew the time of day to be in certain areas. So I think it was a little bit competitive as far as just knowing, kind of like knowing the opposition. On the other hand, it was very gratifying because you actually can, you were able to print your own photo to be on the wall for maybe a year. And then, you know, we change them out. But anyway, it was just while I was doing it and printing, and I still, as I say, I still print a lot. I've got thousands of negatives and transparencies. But I do it now. I scan them, and then I print them with digital printers, big printers.
The technology is amazing now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's wonderful. They've got, I mean, the latest inks I'm using in my particular brand of printer is 200-year, plague-resistant for 200 years, which is better than any color I ever printed back when I was printing, you know, conventionally. White still lasts a long time, but this black and white lasts for 200 years. That's going to be longer than anybody knows who I am.
Want more of the best of the Bald-Faced Truth radio show? Leave it right here. More with John Canzano. You're listening to the best of the Bald-Faced Truth radio show.
Jim Otto, legendary Raiders center, 1974 AFC championship game, matched up with Mean Joe Green. Gotta ask him what that was about. Jim Otto joining us now. What was that like, that battle in 74 with Joe Green?
Well, playing against Joe Green was a battle all through the game, and he's very tough. He was a guy that went beyond tough, and it was something I didn't like. It's not my brand of football playing, but Joe was, like they said, Mean Joe Green. And you can't take that away from him because he'd do anything to immobilize you or break your spirit. And that was something that we always fought against. And it was a great game. I'll never forget that game.
Jim Otto, our guest, 9-time AFL All-Star, 3-time Pro Bowler, AFL champion in 1967. You made the AFL all-time football team. When you see a Super Bowl week coming like this, what do you think about and what do you remember Super Bowl II, Vince Lombardi's Packers?
Well, it was a great time for me. I grew up in northern Wisconsin and naturally watched the Packers as I was a youngster and went off to school, got drafted by the Raiders, played with the Raiders, and now I'm playing against Vince Lombardi's great Packer team. And it was a great team. You can't take that away from them. But I thought that we'd give them one heck of a fight that game, and we had just a few mistakes that were made. And if I had watched the films last night, I could have told you every one of those mistakes. But it was a great game. It was a great feeling for me. I was very disappointed to lose to the Pack because all my family was there from Wisconsin, and you want to win.
When I look at the length of time that you played and the physical demands of that position, I have to think that you played hurt, you played through pain. What does it feel like for you when you get out of bed in the morning now?
Well, it's definitely different now than it was, 5 years ago. And I do have problems. I've got one leg now. So when I get out of bed, I have to put on an artificial leg. And the other leg was broken 2 years ago in five places, and it still hasn't healed properly. And I fell down the other morning getting up to put my leg on, and I had laid on the floor for about 20 minutes before my wife could come and help me. So, these are things that have happened to me. There's more than that, really, but I don't complain about it. I don't talk about it that much. But when I do, I just look at it more as some of the medals I'm carrying from the various games that I played. And I tried my best all the time.
When you look back and you physically say, you look at, the injuries that you had, is it worth it? Would you make that trade again, or would you have approached it differently?
I had a tremendous career, and I would naturally like to come out of it in better condition than I am right now. But I've impressed a lot of different people with different ideas, different thoughts. I've been able to be someone who I try to help people all the time, and if somehow a young person watches Jim Otto play football or sees a film of me the way I played, he's going to see the closest thing to perfection, and it gives a young person very possibly the desire to try and do like I did. That's the way I look at it.
Jim Otto, Hall of Famer with us. What did John Madden, what was he like on a daily basis when you played for him?
John was always very intense, as I was. It was the type of man that I loved to play football for. Intensity in my life, whether I'm in business or whether I'm in anything that I've done since I left football, has been a very part of my life. When I go to work, when I have my businesses, when I own my ranches, I went to work every day with a form of intensity that I needed for the day. And John Madden was a type of guy like that, and that's the type of coach that I like to play for.
That organization was so unique with the personalities, with Madden, with Tom Flores, with Al Davis around, and Gene Upshaw, and yourself, and Stabler, and the identity of the Raiders. Have they lost that now, or can they get back to that?
I think they can get back to it. I don't think it's lost. When those athletes walk down the halls in our facilities, in our football facilities there, they see pictures of the past. They see how things were, and they also see the records that we set at various different times, and they know that that's what they have to get to. They have to get to that point. They have to get that satisfaction as well.
Jim Otto with us. This Super Bowl matchup, you like the matchup? Who you got?
Yeah, I like it. I think that Carolina, along with the kid quarterback there, You know, he's motivating himself the way, you know, he dances, the way he is around his players and everything. So they've got a lot going for him. And, you know, Denver, they've got an old quarterback, and I feel sorry for Peyton at times because of what he's going through. Sometimes I see him, his release on the ball, throwing a pass is not as quick as it used to be. And probably some of his judgments aren't as good either. But he's still a great football player, one of the greatest quarterbacks ever to play the game. And I think that it's going to be a good game this week. I think Peyton's going to have, this next week I mean, Peyton's going to have his team fired up, and as well as Carolina.
When you moved towards retirement, how did you know it was time to go, or how close were you at different times of your career? You know, 217 games played. When did you know?
Well, it was actually 308 all with the postseason AFL, yeah. And preseason games, and I knew that the injuries that I had had and the surgeries I had had up to that point, say for instance in 1973 going into or 74 going into the 1975, I knew that my body had it, and I wanted to go out and have people still say, there's Jim, he walked off the field. And that's all I wanted. I didn't need anything more than that. I just needed a pat on the back, a game well done. I still think of it every day. I've got people that I see all the time, new people that I shake my hand, and that's encouragement for me to go on with the injuries that I have right now. Those handshakes of appreciation, and I love it all.
I'm looking at all the Pro Bowls you played in, and you know those were games, and yeah, John Madden as your coach even in 1970 on a Pro Bowl team. The game now has come to the point where players don't want to play in it. And so, you know, the great players don't play, and then we end up getting the backup of the backup playing in the game. What was the Pro Bowl like in 1970, or what was an AFL All-Star game like in the 60s?
It was an honor. It was a complete honor, really. I looked forward to it. I think I played in 12 of them. And it truly was an honor. It was my parents, my wife, my children, and it was a great honor to be with those players that made it with me from the various different teams. I've got just tremendous friends and friendships that were grown from that that game. And I think that the players today are probably a little afraid of getting hurt in that game, which could end their career in a game that doesn't mean that much to them. It meant a lot to us, and the score didn't mean that much. There was a lot of pride involved, and every one of the Oakland Raiders that played in the Pro Bowl were always a very important part of that game that day. They always worked their hardest, and along with the teammates, along with the other guys that were there. I won't take that away from anybody else. But I don't think today they look at it as that important. That and then probably the amount of money they're getting paid, they don't have the type of desire that they might have with, you know, you're playing in a game on 1 or 2 weeks in a championship game, and you get $60,000 maybe. I'm just using that number for the heck of it, but. Usually that's what they would get on a Sunday playing a game, and in the Pro Bowl they might get a total of, I don't know what they get paid today, maybe around $4,000. So they look at that, the injury versus the amount of money they receive, and they don't want to play in it.
Jim Otto, Hall of Famer, our guest. Could you fix it? Could you fix that by making it an All-Star game, making bigger incentives, or is this ship sailed?
Well, I don't think. I mean, it should be an honor, really, to be able to play in that game and be with another, say, 40 guys that are going to be there, and you're all in the same shoes going against 40 guys in another on the other team, and to just if you're going to match your talents and stuff between them, it's a good place to do it, and there is a lack of that feeling, I think, in the lack because of the lack of compensation, and that is important to the fear of injury, and you know that's important too. So it can ruin a person's career right there. I mean, you could get an injury that you know might end your career, but we never thought of it that way. We thought of playing football just like we did for our home team.
Jim Otto, our guest, legendary Raiders center. The game, we had Franco Harris on. He talked about the immaculate reception game. But I don't want to talk about Franco. I want to talk about you catching a pass in that game. Your only pass reception of your career. What happened?
Well, somebody hit the quarterback's hand, and the ball came flopping, and it was flopping and kind of it wasn't a spiral or anything. And it, I just saw that ball come, and I grabbed it, and I tried to run with it. If I had been just a little bit faster, I would have scored, and we would have won the game. I mean, you believe that? Huh?
Yeah.
If I'd have been just a little bit faster.
Crazy legs, Otto, they would have had you. You know, that would have been a highlight for the ages.
I know. I was turning 38 years old, and I, you know, I'm thinking I'm in my 15th year of pro football. And I'm catching passes and trying and thinking I can run for a football for a touchdown. That's great.
But if you're like any other lineman, yeah, that time before practice, you're probably throwing a ball around all your life.
I've been throwing and catching footballs up until just the last. I still do with my grandsons. I had a grandson in Victor, Idaho, make the All-State team. As a an end and a linebacker, I'm really proud of him. He's a senior this year. I've got another Otto grandson coming up at the same in Driggs, Idaho, at the Driggs High School that he's going to play for three more years, and I'm going to be there watching him every week. And you know, it just it's a thrill for me to see men, boys compete. And competition is so important in life. You know, right now we're going through the presidential election periods and all of the propaganda that they spew out. But it's interesting to see the type of competition they put to each other. And in football, that's what I looked at for all the time. I wanted to beat the guy in front of me to help beat the guy on each side of me with my teammates. And win the football game.
You like Donald Trump or not feeling him?
No, I like Donald. I mean, Donald, well, he's not like me, but because he was born with a gold spoon in his mouth. But he's worked hard, and he's, like someone said, he's a deal maker. Well, what's wrong with a deal maker? If Obama had made some deals, we wouldn't be in all the mess that we are right now with all the problems with all these countries in the Middle East, and so there's nothing wrong with making deals. You gotta be able to do that.
Jim Otto with us. You had Gene Upshaw next to you on that offensive line. Both of you go into the Hall of Fame. What was it like for that extended period to have the two of you together? I cannot imagine the synergy you had.
Well, there was all we knew what each other was doing at all times. I mean, he was at my house having barbecues with his family and my family. He was with us all. My offensive line used to Sally and I used to have him over all the time, and we were that close. We had a real family. The Raiders have always had a family of players, and with Upshaw, George Beeler, Bob Brown. You know, our other offensive tackle, just Art Shell, just a phenomenal bunch of guys. And you could always rely on them. We'd get in the huddle. We'd look at each other in the eye. We'd say, we got to get a better block. Let's go get them. Okay, the quarterback could call a play, and we'd go out there and do it.
When Al Davis left the Raiders, what did they lose?
Well, we lost our, basically, we if you could call it a heart of the team, he was it. He was the man who basically approved everything that we were doing. He worked with his coaches. He worked with his general manager, if he had one at that time. And but also he was very good to all of us players, and he's a person that we'll all remember and always remember, and I miss him dearly.
You were undersized, and that kind of followed you to the NFL when, you know, you were coming out of college, and were you worried that no one would give you a shot?
Well, to a point, someone told me that one time, and I said, well, I'll show you. And I was 217 pounds the first time I put on a professional helmet. And I went, I was lifting weights, and then back in the 50s, weightlifting wasn't done by many football players. There were some. But I kind of kicked it in the butt and went after it. And I went from 217 to 245 my rookie year. Then I went from 245 continuing till I was about 276 pounds playing offensive center.
What did you do to get to that weight?
Lifting weights. I probably had a few of those good Oregon beers, too.
I would have to think you're just trying to, because you're competing against guys on the other side of the ball who, at least initially, they had 20, 30, 40 pounds on you. Is that right?
That's right, but I hit one time like I hit 100 times in that game the same way. The opponent that was across from me, and I'm not bragging, it's just that that's my game, and that I would, you can ask any of those other guys, I would hit the same the first play of the game as I would the last play of the game.
That was important to you, to just kind of send a message that, hey, I'm going to be the same player at the beginning as I am at the end?
That's right.
Guys play that way anymore, or have they softened up?
Well, I would say there's guys out there that play that way. I can't really put them down. I respect these kids. They got tremendous talents, and as I was getting into my career, towards the end of my career, I watched them come into our camp and show what they could do, and it was always inspirational to me to see it still being done, and I would keep right up with them.
Jim Otto, hey, we really appreciate your time and the stories that you've got and your experience, and congratulations on the Hall of Fame. You've been in there a long time, and you deserve it.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to the best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show. Stay tuned for more.
I want you all to listen up. This is important stuff, all right?
Okay. Here we go.
The Bald-Faced Truth.
Call 503-417-7575 or 877-733-0750 or text to 64636.
Here we go in 3, 2.
Now, from the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, here's John Canzano with a Bald-Faced Truth. Welcome to a special edition of the Best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show.
Over the years, I've been in press boxes, working for 6 different newspapers, writing columns. And I've looked, as I walked through the tailgate area, I guess with some envy, A, at sports fans who get to just enjoy this as a diversion, and B, especially in college football, when you see the parents and players and the families and friends, and thought, what a cool thing that would be to travel around and see your kid play football games. It never dawned on me that somebody else in the press box might be simultaneously working or covering the game or have had that experience and also have the joy of watching their kid play. Larry Fitzgerald Sr., for more than 3 decades, has been a sports writer, a producer, a talk show host, a commentator, columnist with the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, radio show, also father to Larry Fitzgerald Jr., and he joins us now. What has that been like for you to be a journalist and then watch your son sort of rise to the level that he's playing at?
Well, thanks for having me. It's been very enjoyable, to be honest. When you you know, when you're blessed to have a child, and you know, I lost my first son, and then subsequently Larry was the firstborn, and then Marcus the second. And so, you know, my wife and I worked real hard to make certain that we provided the foundation for him. You know, brought him up in the church as we were as children, and you know, made certain that they understood how important it was to set goals and to be smart about making the right decisions, to be a leader and not a follower. And so, it's been really enjoyable to see your son, you know, take the initiative and just get a little better from a young pup to, you know, to peewee, to high school, to college, and obviously now in the pros, being one of the best players in the league. It's been very, I can't tell you how excited I've been watching him progress and mature as a man over these last 32 years.
It struck me, I think it was last year during the playoffs or maybe 2 years ago, I was in the press box deep in the playoffs, might have even been the Super Bowl, and I saw your son in the press box, and he was working in a media capacity for somebody, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. And then somebody said, yeah, his dad, you know, covers gay. His dad is a media member. And I thought that was fascinating. Were you able to see players do it the wrong way and talk to Marcus and Larry both about, hey, look, I've seen this. Did they have that perspective through your eyes? Was that a benefit to both of them?
I think it has. You know, I've covered, I think it's going to be 36 Super Bowls for me this year. And obviously I'm they say the first sports writer to cover his own son in the Super Bowl. And the Cardinals lost that tough one to the Pittsburgh Steelers, who at the last second grabbed their sixth Super Bowl title. You know, and raising, you know, Larry and, you know, being with my wife, we both were working full time. And so me as a journalist, you know, I get to cover, you know, the Vikings and Twins and go for university sports, whether it be football or basketball or whatever. And then, you know, in terms of hockey, National Hockey League with the Wild, it started out with the North Stars. And then, you know, to look at what's going on with everything else in this town, I've been able to cover all the games. And so I was able to take Larry and Marcus to many practices and obviously to games. And as youngsters, they were able to sort of salivate on their dream of being able to not only play the game as a young child, but to be able to see some of the stars, whether it be Michael Jordan or who I had and had a great relationship with, or was the late, great Kirby Puckett, who's a Hall of Famer in Twins baseball. All the, just many Vikings from, you know, Randy Moss to Chris Carter. I did Dennis Green's radio show and build a network around it, the National Programming Network, for 10 years when he was here. And that's when Larry and Marcus were ball boys. So they had a tremendous opportunity while they were, you know, in high school to be around a lot of great athletes and to learn from them and to be able to talk to them. Kevin Garnett, I can go on and on and on. Just so many where they were able to learn from them. You know, they learned from Tiger Woods. He had his first foundation camp here in Minneapolis back in 1999. And so it's been a lot of that with the God-given ability that he has and the work ethic. That combination has put him in a tremendous position to, you know, have a career that might lead to the Hall of Fame.
I've got two daughters, and I think about myself often as, hey, I'm a father first. When you are covering a Super Bowl, and I was at that Super Bowl as well, so we've been in the press box together. When you're covering a Super Bowl and your kid's playing, are you allowed to cheer?
Absolutely not. No, it's you know what? I really marvel at how excited people got and all the attention that it made that year, because I think they assume that as a parent, you're not going to be a professional, that you're not going to do what I've done for now 37 years. This is what I do. I understand the game. When I cover a game, I'm not just watching Larry. I'm covering the entire game. I'm covering what happens and evaluating the entire atmosphere and, you know, the pregame and the postgame where you go and get the information from the participants and that type of thing. So the story is always told in so many different ways. And so, yes, it was great to have and it is great to see your son performing and you to be there working at an assignment. But I never get into personalizing it into watching Larry. It's about the game. It's about what happens and getting that story and, you know, beating you guys, everybody else, to get that story out of it.
Larry Fitzgerald Sr. is our guest. The Dennis Green, you mentioned your son is a ball boy and both sons is ball boys. Dennis Green is coach of, in Minnesota at that time. Later, when the Cardinals pick your son, it's Dennis Green again. That was not accidental, was it? He knew what he was getting.
Absolutely. You know, there was a big rumor during the time that Dennis Green was coach of the Vikings and Larry was a sophomore at in high school here at the Academy of Holy Angels, that Larry Fitzgerald in high school could play in the National Football League. You know, he's a two-time All-American and just had just great skills with the football, his vision and his ability to go and attack the ball and catch it with his hands. And so my friend Dennis Green, in many ways, developed Larry through teaching him as a ball boy just things that coaches teach their own players. And Larry has always had his ear open and been able to be understanding of, hey, this is only a short window while I'm working out here as a ball boy. But when the work is done, then I get to work on myself and get myself better. And that means talking to a Chris Carter, a Randy Moss, a Jake Reed, a Robert Smith, a Dante Culpepper, a Brian Billick, who became a head coach, obviously, and went on and took the Ravens to a Super Bowl championship, and Tony Dungy. He's learned from all those guys, and he's been able to suck up a lot of information from them, and he has applied it to himself personally with his work ethic, and that certainly has benefited him. And when Dennis Green became coach of the Cardinals, it was just amazing how, you know, there are things that can happen in a determined, and you don't know how it's going to work out. But I had no doubt, and Dennis told me that if Larry was there on the board when the Cardinals had the third pick, that they would take Larry in the first round, and they did that.
Larry Fitzgerald Sr. is our guest, and again, longtime media member, Minnesota spokesman, recorder, also radio host, internet. Yeah, you're cutting edge. I mean, you evolved as the industry evolved. When you look at the Cardinals in the, you know, in this NFC title game, everybody wants to talk about Carson Palmer's hand and whether or not he's going to be right. What do you think of what you saw in their playoff game against Green Bay?
Well, I didn't think the Cardinals particularly played their best game. They did win the game, as we know, 26-20 in overtime. But, you know, the first half was a battle for them. I mean, they had several opportunities to score in the red zone, and Carson Palmer threw a couple of interceptions, a couple of balls floated on him. And I think even on one of his first or second passes in the game, I saw one of his throws kind of sail over Larry's head, and I said, boy, you know, that's not normally Carson. He's usually right on.
I think back to your son's career, and I remember I saw him play in person in college when Oregon State played Pittsburgh in a bowl game in San Francisco. And that was, you know, very, you know, I was looking back because Dennis Erickson was coaching that Oregon State team, and he was blown away by your son. And I find out later that it wasn't much later that his mother, Carol, your wife, passes away from breast cancer. How did that change the family dynamic and you now moving into having two sons that you're parenting yourself?
Well, that was Larry's sophomore year in college, and yes, it was at, I think, Bank One Ballpark in downtown Phoenix. And yes, it was against Oregon
State. That's
right. And that was quite the game. And I think Larry made a sensational catch where he dove at the five-yard line and somehow stayed in the air long enough to catch it while diving into the end zone. And that day, that game, ironically, being in Phoenix, downtown, was the last game that Christmas weekend, being in that bowl game, that was that my wife saw him play. Yeah. That was the last time she got to see him because she passed away subsequently in April of 2003. And so his sophomore year, obviously he came back and had the, you know, just a tremendous year and you know, nearly won the Heisman or should have. And obviously went on to the National Football League. So it was a real tough deal to lose, obviously, your partner of 24 and a half years in marriage. We went to high school together, and we had a plan to be together and to raise our family, and we did that. And so all of a sudden, when something happens like that, you got to just keep forging on. And we were able to, you know, get Larry through and then get Marcus into college. He went on to play and get his education at Marshall and played very well for the Thundering Herd. And so we've been really blessed as a family, and certainly I've been fortunate to be able to see my boys continue to be able to do the things that, you know, we kind of laid out for them in terms of being good people, good citizens, and I'm really proud of that as well.
You know, a lot is made of you covering that Super Bowl. Do you ever just go to a game as a fan and as a dad and sit in the stands?
You know what I did when he was in high school and Marcus, I enjoyed that, to be on the sidelines watching him play, because I felt like I was kind of coaching him, because when they came to the sideline, I would, you know, tell them things. I just never have been one to be able to sit in the stands and watch a game. I don't know. I can't explain why it is, or I just couldn't. In fact, the last game I went to as a fan, technically, was in Larry's, I think it was his freshman year or sophomore year, they were playing a number three undefeated Virginia Tech, the Hokies, down in Blacksburg, Virginia. And I want to tell you, it was one of the coldest nights I can remember. And here I am as a fan sitting in the stands watching my kid play, and I didn't dress properly. I only had like a shirt on, so I was, man, was I uncomfortable. I was cold and had icicles on my mustache. And so when my son saw me after the game, I let him know that, hey, you know what, from now on, I'm going to stay in the box and work games, because this being in the stands thing when you're not prepared is not a good deal.
I also think, like, as a writer, I'm always watching a game, and I have a hard time relaxing and watching because I'm thinking, what would I write? What's the deadline? What time is it right now? Those things are always in the back of my mind.
Yeah, it's, you know what, for me, I'm taking notes through the game, keeping track of, you know, beginning and end. And, you know, as we are in the box, we always get so much, you know, information provided to us, the numbers. And then yeah. I've always been one to try to build my story, not only around what I see and what I'm able to get from terms of interviews, but also take the numbers and provide for a reader or a listener, you know, how the game played out in terms of the numbers.
We're talking to Larry Fitzgerald Sr., Cardinals receiver Larry Fitzgerald Jr., playing in the NFC Championship game. I read a story about Larry Jr.'s time at Valley Forge Military Academy. As a parent, how hard was that to, A, send him away from home, and how much growing up did he do there?
Well, it was difficult. You know, he was set to graduate with his senior class at Holy Angels. But the problem was my late wife, when he was a freshman at Minnehaha Academy, another private school, before I transferred him or pulled him out and moved him over to Holy Angels, his GPA dropped big time the second half of the year after the football season because of him finding out and us finding out that my wife had breast cancer. And so, He thought it was his mom was going to die. I mean, as a child, you know, even though as the leader of the family, you're trying to keep everybody positive. We're going to get through this and that type of thing. Children are children, and it was just devastating for him. So his GPA dropped, and that's one of the reasons why, you know, when he finished at Holy Angels, or at least halfway through his senior year, when all these teams were coming in here trying to talk to Larry about going to their school, whether it be Pittsburgh or Oklahoma or Michigan State or whoever it was, they came in here and wanted to, you know, they wanted to find out, you know, if he was interested in then that type of thing, let us know that he wasn't going to be a qualifier. And so that's why we worked really hard to make certain I made the right decision. And I checked with Chris Dolman, who was a Viking at one time, and he went to Valley Forge Military Academy and a couple other guys that had successful careers. And so I found out that going the prep school route was an option. And so that's why in December, at the end of the year, we transferred Larry to Valley Forge Military outside of Philadelphia in Wayne, Pennsylvania. And he spent about a year there. And so he really grew up because it was tremendous discipline that he had to deal with, you know, that militaristic environment. And so he made the most of it. And that's one of the reasons why I'm really proud of him, because it was tough as a parent to take him there and then to leave him. And knowing that this is going to be the first time for him out on his own, and then you're trusting somebody else to do the right things for your child. And so, but we kept our faith and our focus, and he came out of there with flying colors in terms of his GPA and graduated with honors. And Pittsburgh was still there with the same scholarship offer that was there before, after he finished prep school. And that really made us feel good about it.
And I think, you know, you had two sons, and Marcus goes to Marshall. Is that right?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, Marshall. And you've got two sons. And I think all the time people who have kids who are gifted in sports are looking for, all right, how do I best protect my kid? How do I get him to the next level? What advice do you give to parents who may have a kid who's extremely gifted and maybe is starting to hear from colleges? Is there some wisdom there that as you look back, you say, okay, this is what we learned?
Well, you got to keep it. Remember, it's always the decision of the child. It's not really what you want. It's what you want for him. And so once you lay it out and provide him with all the information, and then find out where his athletic level will take him, if he gets him a scholarship, then you sort of roll and make the right decision based on, you know, what opportunity is going to be provided for him. And so that's why it's really trusting yourself, trusting your child, and then having them make the right decision that they believe going to this school over another is going to work for him, because he's done all the right things in terms of listening to some of the things that you, me, who played football, had scholarships, had a chance to play professionally, would pass on to him, that these are things you got to look out for. And so that's how, as a parent, you got to make certain that, you know, it's the child that makes the decision. You don't make the decision for them. You let them make it because it's their life. They're the ones that are going to have to go to college.
Larry Fitzgerald, Sr., all right, good luck to you. Hope to see you in the press box at a Super Bowl covering your kids soon.
Looking forward to it. Hey, thanks again.
Want more of the best of the Bald-Faced Truth radio show? Leave it right here. The Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano. You're listening to the best of the Bald-Faced Truth radio show.
Appreciate everybody who makes the Bald-Faced Truth radio show part of their day. I know you've got options, and I love that you lock it in here. We are recounting some of the best interviews that we've done on this radio show in our 10-year run, and that continues today. Make sure that you are following this show on Twitter. Follow me, at John Canzano BFT. Also, subscribe to the Bald-Faced Truth radio show on SoundCloud and iTunes. You won't miss a thing. Did an interview in March of 2016 with Celtics coach Brad Stevens. Thought it was an interesting look at a guy who's made the transition from college basketball to the NBA in a successful way. Here's that interview. Brad Stevens, coach of the Boston Celtics. He took Butler to a couple of Final Fours. He's played for national titles. He's now in the NBA, and he joins us now. What's it like being a coach on the road in the NBA, bouncing from city to city?
I don't know. For me, it's, you know, I'm a pretty boring guy, John. I mean, other than, you know, occasionally leaving my room to find a place to go to dinner, usually I just order in. I'm just watching film and getting ready for the next one. So I would say that I'm probably the least, you know, probably the most boring person you could ask about that as far as NBA travel goes, and because I don't really do a whole lot.
I've heard NBA people talk about the NCAA tournament, kind of when you play that Thursday-Saturday game in March Madness and then the NBA schedule where you're doing your own thing. They've drawn comparisons because when you're on the road and you're going from city to city or you're on a back-to-back, are you more focused on your own stuff or what the opponent's doing? And is there a similarity when you're playing a Thursday-Saturday game in college, or is that apples and oranges?
You know, I think that there is some similarity. Obviously, the back-to-back takes it to a whole different level, because I've always thought that to adequately prepare for an opponent, you probably need three times together. And, you know, that's usually a practice, maybe two film sessions, or maybe it's a shoot around and two film sessions, whatever the case may be. And obviously on a back-to-back, all you really get is a film session and a walkthrough in a hotel. And so I think generally in the NBA, you end up needing to spend more time on your own team and what you can control, because it's a lot harder to game to game change. Obviously, you're going to run your system. You're going to make tweaks in the game. You get more used to making those tweaks. You get more used to those changes the longer you have continuity in your roster, because, you know, over time you see scenarios, you react to scenarios, and then you can refer back to them. I would say that in college, especially in the NCAA tournament, one of my favorite parts was, you know, getting your opponent on Sunday, whether that was when you heard Selection Sunday announcement, or you were moving on to the Sweet 16, or ultimately to the Final Four, and then preparing all week for that one opponent and being able to take things away. And certainly it's a quicker turnaround, obviously, when you go Thursday, Saturday, or Saturday, Monday, or whatever the case may be. But now that I'm in the NBA, it looks like a long turnaround to me.
I hear people over and over that will say things like, you know, in the NBA, coaching doesn't matter, but I'm watching what Terry Stotts has done with the Blazers, and I'm like, absolutely, it matters. I see what you've done in Boston. You've got a team that's fighting to host a playoff series. That matters. Give us an idea of the difference between coaching in college and coaching in the pros.
Well, I think there's a lot of differences. I think, number one, the biggest difference is in the lack of practice to game time that you get. So the ratio in college, I mean, I think if I remember correctly, we were into the 100th practice by the time we were preparing for the Final Four. And, you know, I think we had played 37 or 38 games in each of those seasons, you know, and in the NBA, yesterday was our 52nd practice and we've already played 75 games. You just have to, I think you have to have a great first week as far as training camp goes. You have to know generally what your strengths and weaknesses are going to be and play to that, play to your strengths. And then, again, tweak as you go along. I have so much respect for these guys in this league because, you know, especially the older players, they've seen so much, they've experienced so much that they really can tweak on the fly incredibly well, much more so than the typical 18 to 20-year-olds. 18 to 22 year olds that you're going to coach in college. And so I think that that's one advantage that you have, but at the same time, you can't, the lack of preparation time in practice and that teaching part is certainly way, way different. So it's a different, you know, you have to focus your time differently. You have to spend more time in short film sessions. You have to, spend more time getting ready on your own, and then making game adjustments that you think are appropriate and going from there. But, you know, basketball is basketball at the end of the day. There are a lot more similarities and differences, but that to me is the biggest difference.
Brad Stevens, coach of the Boston Celtics, is our guest. I watch teams, especially earlier in the year in the NBA, the team that's playing harder wins the game. How do you get guys in the league to play hard when the talent is so – there's so much parity with talent?
So I think that, you know, obviously one of the things that I've loved about watching the Golden States of the world and, you know, certainly San Antonio's dominance since, you know, for a long time, but certainly in the 3 years that I've been in the league is teams like that just enjoy playing the game, you know, and I think that when you really enjoy it, you're going to play with great passion. When you're really having fun, you know, whether it's together or your passion for the game comes out, then you're going to play with great effort. And I think that, you know, that's a huge part of having success at any level in basketball. And I believe Jeff Van Gundy's old line, that is, if you want your guys to play hard, get hard playing guys. I mean, it's not, you know, you're not, Newt Rockne's not going to make a guy that doesn't play that hard play hard 82 times. It's not the way it works.
It's fascinating to kind of watch, you know, things unfold, you know, with you in coaching basketball, but also kind of the celebrity that you become at Butler and then with the Celtics. You got a write-in vote in one of the primaries for president.
Yeah, that's, well, I don't know if that's a, I don't know.
Is that good?
No, I don't think so.
Would you want that job?
No, I tell you what, John, I like a scoreboard. You know, I'm not a politics person. I like knowing the result at the end of the night based on how well you played and, you know, and being, you know, obviously on that left side of the columns, a huge rush, and being on that right side presents a huge challenge of getting back up off the mat and playing the next day. But yeah, it's the whole idea of people knowing who you are, or, you know, the idea of that write-in vote, whatever the case may be, is, you know, it's always to me been secondary to, you know, and far secondary, and something that's really, I'm not even really comfortable with, to just being a coach and, you know, more important than that, being a husband and a dad. And so I don't know. That's for other people to judge the level of how well people know you. But it's certainly not something I enjoy by any means.
I was covering Oregon and St. Joe's in the NCAA tournament, and I got a chance to talk to Phil Martelli, who was telling a story about how nervous he is on game days, especially, you know, in the NCAA tournament. And he said he was at the Final Four in Indianapolis. You had Butler there, and he looks out the window, and you're going for a walk. And he was just shaking his head, like, how relaxed you were. I see you on the sidelines. You have that poise. Are you going nuts inside internally ever?
You know, a little bit. I think, John, this is the part of coaching that is probably the one thing that I don't like about it as much, is that this becomes much more your job. Right. And so you're much more focused on preparing to do your job well. And just like you getting ready for a radio show or somebody else in a different line of work, when you prepare well, or when you feel like you've prepared well, you're probably not quite as nervous about the task at hand. And, you know, I've had moments over the past 9 years as a head coach where I was really disappointed in how well prepared I was for that game. And I probably let my emotions get the better of me because I was taking that out on myself. And I think that I feel you have to put all the time in, and you have to put all the extra time in as a coach to just be prepared for every scenario. And I had great bosses. And one of the bosses that I worked for was Todd Licklider, who was the coach at Butler for 6 years. And he used to quote Lincoln all the time. He used to say, "I apologize for the length of this letter. I didn't have time to write a short one." And I think that's the coach's job, right? The coach's job is to simplify things. The coach's job is to be prepared for every twist and turn and let the players showcase themselves and all their great talents in what otherwise is a very simple game. And I think that my job is not to clutter it, and I think I could clutter it two ways, by making it overly complicated or certainly by being on edge.
Brad Stevens, Boston Celtics coach, is our guest. As you look at the Blazers, you watch them on film, what do you see them doing now, and how different are they from the last time you seen them?
Well, it's interesting because it's a team that, you know, when I was coaching in college, I didn't pay a lot of attention to, because, you know, you're on most of the time at 10 Eastern or 10:30 Eastern. By that time, you know, I am laying down, going to bed, and getting ready for our 6:30 a.m. practice the next day at Butler. So, coming into the league, I probably didn't know a ton about the system or really the players themselves. And obviously the players have changed a little bit. Some have stayed the same, but I've really a huge fan and have stolen quite a bit from Terry. And the way that his teams play. I think that the way that they move the ball on offense, the ability to play freely and confidently while still being very organized is really, really good. And, you know, I just appreciate the way that these guys play. I think we're a lot alike, the two teams, as far as who we are right now, in that we've got a bunch of guys that, for whatever reason, have chips on their shoulders. And those chips have been, you know, because somebody told them somewhere along the way they weren't the right fit for them, you know, whether it's Damian Lillard ending up at Weber State or C.J. McCollum ending up at Lehigh, or, you know, guys on their team that have been now in their second or third NBA stop, and now they've found the right niche, and they're loving it because they get to showcase competitively what they can do on a given night. And I think we have a lot of that on our team too.
Can you assemble a team of guys with chips on their shoulder, or is that one that you'd have to walk around eggshells with, because those are probably guys that are easily offended as well?
Well, I've made a coaching living off of it.
Yeah.
So I believe in it wholeheartedly. You know, I think that everybody's got great strengths. There's a reason that all these guys are in the league. They all can do something extraordinarily well. And a lot of times, for whatever reason, we pigeonhole them into positions, or we really dwell on the things that they don't do as well. And I think that one of the things as a coach, especially when your roster is given to you at the start of the season, or it is what it is, right? After the trade deadline, this is your team. You have to figure out what each guy does well and just try to put them in position to do that. That doesn't mean that you're not going to eventually have to manage those weaknesses as a player. It doesn't mean you're not going to have to work on them, get them better. And some guys get them to the point where they become strengths, but every one of these guys does something at such an elite level, and their resolve and their ability to bounce back and play this 82-game schedule has made me in awe of the kind of basketball players and athletes they are. And, you know, hey, we're going to soar with those strengths.
Do you watch the NCAA tournament?
You know, I don't watch full games except for Butler. So I watched the Butler-Virginia game in full. We were in Philly. I got a room. Former player of ours came over that was in Philly at the time working, and we watched it together. But other than that, I've watched like the end of games, or, you know, I saw the Virginia Syracuse. I was not really paying attention. Then all of a sudden it's a 3-point game. I watched the end of that, but I don't watch it as closely because I have work to do.
Yeah.
You know, we've had a bunch of games in this run, and, but I don't miss a Butler game when I can sit down, and I make sure that I plan my 2 hours around that.
The Final Four, because we hear and see on the men's side and the women's side too, because Oregon State's playing UConn in the women's Final Four. And we do a lot of talking about the pressure of being in a Final Four. You were there in 2011 and 2012. What did you learn in 2011 that you could put to work in 2012? Or was it just another basketball game on a big stage?
You know, what's funny is our guys knew the magnitude of the moment. I don't think there's any question about it. But I don't know, and maybe they would say this different, but I don't know that I ever sensed it from them, that they were feeling heat. And I've said this before, when we were in a non-BCS, non-Power 5 league, and so what happens in those situations are you play with enormous pressure in January and February, because every loss is like the end of the world, right? Because you're scrutinized, yeah. Because people don't understand how good those teams are. Gonzaga goes through it out here in the West Coast Conference. St. Mary's goes through it in the West Coast Conference. And I think that when you get through that, March is like you're playing with no pressure.
Yeah.
The only time we ever got to the point where I felt like we had a little heat on us was in 2010 and 11, when we started wearing white uniforms in the tournament more often because we were the higher seed, which had never happened before at Butler. You know, I think Butler's won 9 first-round games in the last 10 years that they've been in the tournament. And, you know, and a lot of times we were wearing dark and we were the underdog. And we didn't view ourselves as the underdog from a playing standpoint, but that just adds a layer of freedom that I think you can play with. And that's a reality in the one and done tournament. Like, you know, I laugh when people talk about parity in 5-12 and the 6-11 game. Well, those teams are all the same.
Yeah.
And so all you're doing is throwing heaps of pressure on one and letting the other team play free. Well, who do you think's going to win? Like, and that's the reality of that tournament. That's the beautiful part about that tournament. And it's the part that makes it so much fun and so enjoyable. But from my standpoint, you know, we played free. And I admire our players, because for them to perform on those levels, any kid that goes through this and I watch perform, with the tension that you can cut with a knife in the air in those arenas, man, it's pretty special.
Before I cut you loose, I saw a headline where it said that you don't listen or don't watch the One Shining Moment tribute at the end of the tournament. Is that being overblown, or is that really painful for you?
No, I won't. I won't watch. I haven't watched it since we lost. When we went to the Sweet 16s there in 03 and 07, I used to watch it because it was, you know, you might find five clips of Butler on there and use it in recruiting, you know, you know, you take so much pride because you've never been on that stage before and you've never really had that much attention before. And it was unbelievable, not only for our basketball program, but for the school. But I'll tell you what, when you're standing there on that last day and the confetti falls on somebody else and you lose that game, you turn it off when the confetti starts falling. It's just the way it goes. I think that I'm probably as process oriented a person as you can be in coaching. But I can't watch the celebration. And in fact, you know, I'll watch it in some sports, but I usually watch the end of the game and then turn it off. And it's too bad, because it's kind of like I said earlier, I grew up a fan, and all I did was watch One Shining Moment, and I'd watch it over and over. But I'll let my 10-year-old do that on DVR the next morning while I'm at work.
10-year-old understand dad's a coach and grasp all that, or kind of figuring it out?
10-year-old does. 10-year-old does. 6-year-old still kind of. The 6-year-old. It was funny. We were watching Shelvin Mack play, and they showed a picture of, I think, me and him or something to that regard. And my 6-year-old said, "You coach Shelvin?" Like, she's still like, she was one when Shelvin, you know, led us to the Final Four as a junior. But you know, she's piecing it together. Like, here's the guy that comes and says hi to her anytime he's in the same arena or city that we're in, and now it's kind of piecing together. But the 10-year-old does remember, not greatly, but does remember some of those runs, because he was 5 and 6, and so those were pretty memorable, both runs and people, to him. And so, yeah, he still gets into it quite a bit, and he's passionate about basketball anyway, so that's kind of where his heart lies.
I really appreciate having you on the show. I view you as one of the guys that's coaching that's also a teacher. So it's fascinating to pick your brain and have you on. We'd love to have you back, and maybe in the playoffs, and we wish you the best, Coach.
Thanks, John. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show.